may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Virginia Tyson for the appellant, the Commonwealth of Virginia. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The Double Jeopardy Clause is not violated when a defendant is convicted and sentenced in a single trial for common law involuntary manslaughter and statutory offense of unlawful shooting at a vehicle where death results, which is labeled involuntary manslaughter in the statute. The legislature has not expressly declared its intent regarding multiple punishments for the two offenses. Therefore, the Blockberger test is the appropriate instrument to determine that intent. The Court of Appeals below erred, including finding that all instances of shooting at an occupied vehicle involved criminal negligence. And we are asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and to reinstate the judgment of the Circuit Court. Now, as to legislative intent, neither 182-36, which is the, it just basically has the punishment for the common law crime of involuntary manslaughter, nor 182-154, shooting at an occupied vehicle where death results, contains specialized language with regard to intent. And sometimes some statutes in the code actually do have specialized language indicating the legislature's intent. These statutes do not. But I would like to make a comparison with this case and the case that was decided by the Court of Appeals, which we cited in our papers, which is Gaddy versus the Commonwealth. The reason I want to cite that case is because that case involved the death of a single individual who was charged with lynching by mob and first-degree felony murder. And the statute for lynching by mob says as follows: every lynching shall be deemed murder, and every person composing a mob and every accessory thereto by which any person is lynched shall be guilty of murder. So very similarly to the statute before the court in 182-154, the statute in Gaddy, the lynching statute, says that those principals and accessories shall be guilty of murder. The Court of Appeals in the Gaddy decision determined that the legislature had not intended for either the lynching statute nor the murder statute to displace the other. And therefore, it was not a multiple punishments violation of the Double Jeopardy Clause to convict and sentence for both in a single trial.
As you may know, I'm familiar with that Gaddy decision, and it seems to me the key language is focusing on the legislative intent to inflict multiple punishments as opposed to extrapolating from the absence of legislative intent the intent not to inflict multiple punishments.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. And there is no indication with the statutes that are before this court of an intent by the legislature to prohibit those. These are separate and distinct offenses. And when
so have you, in your research, taking the Gaddy and the Hunter and the Deo line of cases, which is the declared intent point, I've never seen, correct me if this is there, and it is under Virginia law, that flipped to say, well, we don't see that they didn't do it, and therefore we're not going to Blockberger. We're just going to do our best comparing and contrasting without Blockberger.
No, Your Honor, not as a matter of Virginia law. And in fact, the Martin case that we cited from the Fourth Circuit also has the cart in front of the horse, or the horse in front of the cart in that manner. And as I stand here at this moment, there may be an ancient case. I don't remember if Whalen had it the other way around with regard to Congress or not, but I am not aware of a Virginia case, and certainly not a recent case.
So the sequence would be, is there declared intent to inflict multiple punishments? Answer yes, no. Next question, Blockberger.
That's correct. And another case from the Court of Appeals that this court actually did grant, I'll mention that in Gaddy this court denied an appeal and rehearing. But in the Bomber case, which was from the Court of Appeals, this court granted and affirmed for the reasons stated by the Court of Appeals. That precise point is made. In distinguishing Andrews, the Court of Appeals in Bomber indicated that while there was no explicit intent to permit, there was no explicit intent to prohibit, and did the analysis that way, indicating that in that circumstance, then Blockberger is the test. And I would also point this court to the case of Coleman versus Commonwealth, where there was an attempted murder and a malicious wounding. Neither one of those statutes had any specialized language as well. And, of course, that is a case that has stood the test of time for doing a Blockberger analysis where you have in a single trial. I would also note, in response to the arguments from the appellees, that the legislative history of 18-2-154 does not lead to a different result. And, of course, they argued at some length with regard to amendments to the statute, and especially in 2005, where the language was changed from deemed to is. I would point out to the court that the major amendment in 2005 had to do not with unlawfully shooting at a vehicle, but maliciously shooting at a vehicle and what degree of murder that would be. Previously, it was determined by the jury what degree of murder would be involved. And in 2005, the legislature changed that, so there was a presumption that it would be second degree. So neither legislative intent nor legislative history would indicate that multiple punishments were prohibited when tried for this common law and statutory offense in a single proceeding. So we move on to the Blockberger analysis. And the most important thing in a Blockberger analysis, actually there are two. One is that the elements must be viewed in the abstract. As we noted from the Martin case, the particular facts under the case under review is really not relevant to a Blockberger analysis. It is in the abstract. And the second is that the offenses must always be the same. The fact that in many instances an offense could be committed and there would be some overlap, there's not always overlap between the elements of each offense, then the double jeopardy clause is not violated under Blockberger. And perhaps, again, the Coleman case really sets this forth very carefully in that there was a discussion of intent. Coleman involved malicious wounding and attempted murder. And so there can be some overlap with regard to intent, for you can commit malicious wounding with an intent to kill, but you can also commit malicious wounding with an intent to maim, disfigure, or disable. And because there's not always the overlap, this court said that there is no double jeopardy violation. So we need to look at the offenses before the court. And the first one, common law involuntary manslaughter. As recently, or relatively recently, defined in Noakes, involves an unintentional killing in one of two ways. Either in the commission of some unlawful but not felonious act, or in the unlawful performance of a lawful act. And with regard to that second type of involuntary manslaughter, the unlawful performance must rise to the level of criminal negligence. Obviously, common law involuntary manslaughter does not involve necessarily throwing missiles or shooting weapons. It does not involve vehicles or persons in vehicles. Now, if we look at the unlawful shooting at an occupied vehicle where death results, the elements involve an unlawful but not malicious shooting or throwing of a missile at an occupied vehicle where the lives of the occupants may be put in peril and a death results. It does not always involve criminal negligence. It can, but it need not.
How could it not? I mean, if you shoot an occupied vehicle, isn't that in and of itself criminal negligence?
Your Honor, I think that there could be an instance where it does not involve criminal negligence. Certainly,
can you give it to me?
I'm going to try.
Okay.
It would certainly involve some nature of negligence. And let me change the example that we used in our brief just a little bit and say that if I am shooting at an occupied vehicle because I want the vehicle to stop and I shoot at the tire of that vehicle. And I have a reason that I want the vehicle to stop. Someone in the vehicle has stolen property from me, and I want to stop that vehicle.
Right, but there are people in the car.
And
you know that they are in there.
I do know that they're in the car. And shooting at the tire and not at the car. And I hit the tire. And so I have intended that action, and the car is stopped, and someone inside the car dies as a result. I am guilty of unlawfully shooting at that vehicle, but not my actions don't necessarily rise to the level of criminal negligence. I haven't shown that gross, wanton, culpable, reckless disregard of human life that is required for criminal negligence. And so it is possible to commit that crime without engaging in criminal negligence.
And yet your shooting at the tire ended up killing somebody?
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And in doing the abstract examination, and we mentioned this in our papers in the court, in this court, and it does throw a bit, muddy some water just a bit, and that is that this court has always held there's two ways to commit involuntary manslaughter. Now, this court has said when a vehicle is involved, criminal negligence is the standard. But this court has held that common law involuntary manslaughter can be committed without criminal negligence. If an unlawful but not felonious act results in the death, that is one branch of involuntary manslaughter. The other branch is the unlawful performance of a lawful act, and then criminal negligence is involved. And that was not an argument that was made in the trial court or the Court of Appeals, partly because, as we noted in our papers in the Court of Appeals, the Darnell case from 1988 or 89 said that criminal negligence is involved in both types of involuntary manslaughter. This court has not addressed that, according to my research, and the court certainly has not adopted that. This court still recognizes that there are two ways in which common law involuntary manslaughter can be committed. And since that is true, then that actually enhances the argument that these two offenses do not always overlap. So even if this court were to find that criminal negligence was always involved in shooting at an occupied vehicle, still the elements of these two offenses do not always overlap. And because they do not always overlap, then they have passed the Blockberger test. And we must rely on the Blockberger test because we do not have the legislative intent. And therefore, the trial court was correct in convicting and sentencing Mr. Gregg on both of these offenses. I would like to answer any other questions of the court, but if you have none, I will reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right.
Members of the court, good morning. My name is Blair Howard. I represent the appellee, Mr. Gregg. There are two issues in this case. And the first issue is statutory construction. The second issue, it is our position you never get to, and that's the Blockberger argument. And in support of that, I agree that what this court must do is look to the language used in the statute to determine whether or not the legislature authorized cumulative punishment.
May I interrupt you for a second? So you don't think Blockberger is a rule of statutory construction?
I don't believe Blockberger is necessary based on the cases, Your Honor, respectfully, that I cited. That would be the Botkin case, and there's also language in Gaddy which says that if the legislative intent is clear and unambiguous, then the construction by statutory interpretation comes to an end, meaning you never go to Blockberger if the language of the statute is clear. It is our position in this case that the language is absolutely clear and provided for cumulative punishment.
Well, Gaddy says, and I'm quoting, the Blockberger test is simply a rule of statutory construction. And it's quoting the U.S. Supreme Court in Whalen applying Blockberger. So I don't understand the assertion that Blockberger is not a rule of statutory construction. That's actually all it is.
My understanding of what you said, you weren't saying that it's not a rule of statutory construction. You're just saying, in your analysis, you don't get that far.
Yes, sir.
Because you construe the statute differently. But why would you construe the statute differently without using the rule of statutory construction?
Well, I believe the language from Gaddy, if I may read right out of Gaddy quoting Missouri versus Hunter, where the legislature specifically authorizes cumulative punishment under two statutes, regardless of whether those statutes prescribe the same conduct, a court's task of statutory construction is at an end. And the prosecutor may seek, and the trial court or jury may impose cumulative punishment under the statute. Right. So, respectfully, sir, I believe the first step is to look at the statute. And if you look at the third paragraph of 154, it absolutely, clearly, and unambiguously provides for cumulative punishment. If someone violating this statute by maliciously or unlawfully with a firearm and shoots into a conspicuously marked law enforcement, fire, or emergency medical services type vehicle, the sentence imposed shall include mandatory minimum term of imprisonment of 1 year to be served consecutively with any other sentence. So there is specific language in 154 that addresses cumulative punishment. But what the legislature did, the General Assembly, did not apply cumulative punishment to every shooting into an occupied vehicle. They carved out certain types of vehicles: law enforcement, medical, first responders. And it is our position, if you use rules of statutory construction, number one, if the language is plain and unambiguous, you must put the meaning that is intended to the statute. What could be clearer than cumulative punishment? I cited the Ellis case in my brief, and the Ellis case was a case with identical language. The lower court in Ellis had given a person who was in possession of a firearm after having been convicted of a felony a concurrent sentence, found guilty on two counts in Botkin, and there was a concurrent sentence given by the trial court, and the appellant or the attorney general appealed that case, and on the basis that the court had no discretion. The court could not impose concurrent sentences when the language, specialized language used in the statute, provided for cumulative punishment, consecutive sentence to run with any other sentence. The language in Botkin is exactly and identical to the language I just read to you in the third paragraph of the statute. And they not only said that the language was clear, plain, and unambiguous, but they cited three other statutes. They cited 53.1, that's the shooting into an occupied vehicle, and then there's enumerated offenses that are set out in the statute. And the only way that you can come under the umbrella of that statute is to be one of those enumerated offenses. In other words, you've got to commit murder or you've got to commit rape and use of a firearm in order to have the cumulative punishment under 53.1. Well, what we're saying here, that's precisely what we have in 154. The last paragraph of 154 only identifies certain types of vehicles. And in this case, the tow truck driver's vehicle is not one of those enumerated vehicles. Just as in 53.1, if you use a firearm to commit a felony, but you're not one of the enumerated offenses, you cannot be prosecuted under that statute because your offense has not been named. And we cited 53.1 for the reason that manslaughter, either voluntary or involuntary, has not been one of the enumerated offenses. My point simply is this. The legislature, who affixes punishment in a criminal case, has chosen in 53.1 and in 154 to identify in 53.1 specific felony offenses. And if you don't come within one of those specific felony offenses, then you can't be prosecuted under that.
So what's your authority for that? I mean, I see what you're saying is there, but I don't understand your authority for saying
I believe
things that are left out means you can't be prosecuted.
Well, I don't believe. I believe this court is familiar with the proposition that when the legislature changes a statute or changes the law, that anything that is not covered by the statutory change is intended to be omitted. And our position is that by virtue of the fact that they only used the type vehicles enumerated in the statute, that no other type vehicles other than those enumerated by the General Assembly apply. So
the language you're referring to in 154 is a mandatory minimum.
Yes, sir.
It's not really talking at all about legislative intent to impose multiple punishments for a single offense, which is what Gaddy and Hunter are talking about.
Yes, sir, but let's say this. I believe the Gregg case is the first case that I am aware of under 154 that has addressed the issue of cumulative punishment. But by definition, the language they use by saying that that any punishment imposed under this statute shall run consecutively with any other sentence, that is the definition of cumulative punishment. I mean, when the legislature says you can punish twice for conduct under this statute and any other statute the defendant is convicted of in a single trial, that is cumulative punishment.
But I'm not following the logic of that, because if you have two crimes,
yes,
two convictions, and you run the sentences concurrently, there are two punishments. So it doesn't, the cumulative versus consecutive doesn't address the Blockberger question. In fact, if we strip off one of the convictions on appeal, the guy finds out just how important the concurrent sentences were.
Well, respectfully, in the quote I read from Gaddy, I believe the Supreme Court of the United States in Hunter versus Missouri said that where the legislative intent is clear as to what punishment may be imposed.
Well, may I ask this one question on Gaddy, and we'll leave Gaddy alone. It was an unpublished opinion in the Court of Appeals,
yes.
And I'm very familiar with it, and what it's saying and what it's, the language you're quoting, it says this, which is what's said in Blockberger. Generally speaking, they can't punish multiple times. But if they say, if the legislature says, well, actually, we want to punish twice,
yes, sir,
they can do that. There's no constitutional impediment to that. And then Blockberger comes in to say, well, did they intend to do that? So it's not the absence of intent not to inflict multiple punishments that we look at. It's the presence of legislative declaration of intent to inflict multiple punishments. It's the exact opposite, actually, of what you're saying.
Well, I believe that if the whole purpose in going through the analysis that we're going through now is look to the legislative intent. And in Vollmer, the only reason why they said we go to Blockberger is because in the Vollmer case, there was no legislative intent either allowing or precluding cumulative punishment.
If we go to Blockberger, what's the answer to this case? Assuming your first premise is wrong, that we don't just pick intent out of the sky, we have to use some construction principle, and we use Blockberger, what's your best argument that Blockberger says this is multiple punishments?
Well, there are several things that I would like to address in that regard. Number one, if you go to Blockberger, I agree with the Court of Appeals that you come up with the same result. That is, that you cannot have cumulative punishment in this case. And the reason I say that is several. When you go to the cases that I cited, the Ellis case, which reviewed the objective and the purpose of Code Section 18.2.279, which is shooting into an occupied building. They reviewed not only shooting into an occupied building and the purpose of that statute, but they also included the Armstead case, which deals with 154. And they said the Armstead analysis has agreed with the same analysis that we're using in deciding the Ellis case. And that analysis is as follows. The purpose of those statutes, 154 and 279, is to prohibit conduct irrespective of the shooter's motivation, whether it's malicious or criminal recklessness, because we're trying to protect the lives of the occupants of the inside of the building and of the automobile. I think the question you put to the Attorney General, as I understood your question, you saying you shoot at a tire or you shoot at anything in a vehicle, windshield, or shoot at a vehicle that's occupied by a human being. Respectfully, I don't think there's anyone in this courtroom who can say by doing that act that that's not an inherently dangerous act that puts the lives of any individual in that vehicle at risk. I mean, that's common sense. And my point about bringing up the objective and the purpose of the statute is the legislature said, wait a minute, you shoot a deadly weapon at a building or a motor vehicle that's occupied by a human being, that act is so inherently dangerous that we don't care what the motive was of the shooter. We don't care whether it was malicious or we don't care whether it was reckless. The act is so inherently dangerous that that's why we enacted these statutes. Now, when it comes to the Blockburger, respectfully, in response to your question, sir, the jury in this case was instructed, number one, that Mr. Gregg had to take the life of Mr. Sanchez, the driver of the truck. And number two, it had to be the result of criminal negligence. When you go to the statute, there are three things defined unlawful involuntary manslaughter under the statute. You've got to shoot at the occupied vehicle, and those acts have to put the occupant of the vehicle in peril. Again, by definition, the jury had to buy that, but the jury concluded, in fact, that it was such an inherently dangerous act that it constituted criminal negligence. I don't know that they went through that process in their mind as laymen, but the point is, one of the elements was that the act of shooting into the occupied vehicle had to put the life of the individual occupant at peril. So the acts in violation of the statute, every fact necessary to prove a violation of 154 had to be shown to the jury in order to get a conviction under involuntary manslaughter common law. Because all the jury was told was he's got to be responsible for the death of the driver, and then it's got to be willful, wanton, reckless disregard of human life. So without going to the facts of the case, the jury couldn't have come up with a conclusion that that was criminal negligence. They needed the facts of the case. So there was no fact necessary to prove involuntary manslaughter that wasn't necessary to prove statutory involuntary manslaughter.
I think you've answered the question that was posed, and your time has expired.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rebuttal.
May it please the Court, I would like to respond to some of my opponent's arguments. First of all, the mandatory sentence that's involved in the third paragraph of 18.2.154 expresses the intent of the legislature to protect those who are emergency responders in a special way. The legislature does this in other places as well. For instance, the assault on a police officer is a felony, much for the same reason. It does not address cumulative punishments with regard to the shooting, and in fact, the goal of the legislature here was to ensure that one who commits this offense against an ambulance driver, a police officer, etc., would actually serve a certain amount of time for that crime. Secondly, I would like to respond that with regard to the Ellis case, that of course was not a double jeopardy case where the court was making a determination about whether there could be cumulative punishments. And with regard to the jury instruction, granted, the jury was instructed in this case on homicide, and when the jury got down to the manslaughter, absolutely criminal negligence was there. But that's not the task that's before us today in viewing the elements in the abstract, not what happened in this particular case.
Counsel, my hang-up isn't Blockberger. It's the legislature's, by fiat, declaring that this is involuntary manslaughter. So what's wrong with there's common law way to prove it, there's statutory way to prove it, several paths up the mountain, but the bottom line is all of it is involuntary manslaughter. So you can charge both, but at the end of the day, if you prove 154, it's involuntary manslaughter. If you go common law, it's involuntary manslaughter. So you have two, not common law statutory, you have two involuntary manslaughter convictions out of one set of facts. And to me, that's the difficulty. And then we're extrapolating, is there a legislative intent one way or the other?
And I think perhaps the best answer that I can give, Your Honor, is to, as I began, is to look at that 18.2-40, where that lynching statute says, shall be guilty of murder. And then in that particular case, the defendant was convicted of the violation of 18.2-40 and also a first-degree.
But that was a court of appeals case.
Yes, that was. Right. This court denied it. Yes, that was a court of appeals opinion. Yes, sir, it was.
Thank you.
And we would ask this court to reverse the court of appeals. We would ask this court to reinstate the judgment of the circuit court. Thank you.
Call the next case.